This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest on Keeping the Faith this afternoon is Anna Baltzer, who has recently returned from how many trips have you made to Palestine?
I've been there off and on for 3 years, several different trips.
Several different trips. Now, when was your most recent?
I was there during last January during the elections for about, actually only about a week, getting some signatures tied up for my book. But the last time I was there working sort of consistently was in the spring of 2005.
Now, what drew you to go to Palestine?
Well, I grew up as a Jewish American, and I got into this work when I was teaching English in Turkey. I had received a Fulbright scholarship and would spend sort of my vacations traveling around the surrounding countries. And as I was traveling through Iran and Syria and Lebanon, I was taken in by families and individuals in these different countries who, and through my sort of friendships with the people I met in those places, I began to hear for the first time this whole different kind of version of the history and present of Israel and Palestine. That was totally different from anything I'd ever learned growing up as a Jewish American. And that's what really prompted me. I didn't believe it at first. I thought it was propaganda and lies. But it sort of prompted me to do some of my own research and eventually go to Palestine.
Now, listeners to this show know there are many different types of Jewish Americans. What type are you?
I don't know. I try not to do too much categorization, but I guess I consider myself. I wasn't raised religiously, but I my grandmother is a survivor of the Holocaust, and I always had a very strong understanding of the plight of the Jewish people, and that I was a Jewish person, and I identify as a Jewish person.
Where in Europe was your grandmother?
She was she's Polish born, but she grew up in Belgium and actually fled the Nazis for several years before finally escaping, along with my grandfather, to the United States.
And did you also lose, as many Jewish people of that generation did, Jewish families, people in the Holocaust?
Yes, many people. Uh-huh. Most of my grandparents' families were killed.
Hmm. Now, you say you were not raised as a religious Jew, so were your grandparents religious? I mean, did they practice? Were they observant?
My grandmother says that she and her and my grandfather, whom I never met, were both raised in relatively religious families, but they never raised my parents religiously.
At
my
all.
Parents, not at all.
I see. Okay. And so, in terms of the whether you're Reformed or Conservative or Orthodox, that's too far back in your history to mean much to you.
That's right.
Okay. So, in what sense do you identify yourself as Jewish?
I think it's interesting. Judaism is not quite like other religions. I mean, you can be Jewish in the sense that you're religiously a Jewish person, and in sort of a cultural sense. I mean, my grandmother, when I was growing up, I would ask her, you know, what am I? And she would say, well, you're half German, because my father's German, mm-hmm. not Jewish, and you're half Jewish. And I said, well, Jewish, you know, where's that? And she said, well, we were kicked out, you know, for generations. She is one of three sisters, all of whom were born in different countries in Europe, because every time they would eventually be sort of kicked out. And So for that reason, I think that the sort of Jewish identity has evolved beyond sort of nations into just kind of an identity, sort of a cultural identity. And that's what I identify with most mm-hmm. of all.
And when you talk about yourself as a Jewish American, are there people in your family background for whom the creation of the State of Israel was very important? Are there Zionists in your
My grandmother, for example, yeah. For her, Israel has always been sort of the one kind of hope that such a tragedy could not repeat itself.
Mm-hmm. So when you first went to the Middle East, you were in Turkey on a Fulbright scholarship, and congratulations on that, of course. That's a wonderful honor. You were teaching English. Did you choose to go to Israel, or did you choose to go to Palestine, or was there a difference in your mind?
Well, there was a difference in my mind, and I'd been to Israel before. I'd gone on one of these Birthright Israel programs.
Oh, you
I'm
did.
Not sure
uh-huh.
if you've heard about
of,
those.
Of course I have.
And I'd been given I had a blast. I just kind of traveled around Israel for 10 days in a bus.
What year would that have been?
That was in early 2000. Mm-hmm. But I had it didn't give me any exposure whatsoever to the Palestinian narrative. There was no acknowledgement that there was this even really conflict going on, except that we met soldiers. And I think there was almost a kind of there was a lot of glorification, I guess, of Israeli history as opposed to kind of a sort of objective, balanced view of what actually has gone on and what continues to go on today. So I had been to Israel before, but I had never been to the occupied territories, and I'd never really had any understanding of what Palestinians have gone through. So when I made that decision to go after having traveled through the Middle East, it was specifically to actually meet Palestinians and hear about their history and their lives.
And I want to get to that experience and what you learned. But before we do, let me just take another minute. When you went the first time to Israel on the Birthright Israel sort of package tour by bus with tour guides who are Israelis.
Yes.
Where had you come from? Were you in school then?
Yeah, I was at Columbia then.
So your undergraduate degree is Columbia in New York.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. University.
And do you have graduate degrees as well?
No.
And what did you study as an undergraduate?
Mm-hmm. Mathematics and economics.
Okay. So you were teaching math, or you said you were teaching English.
Actually, I was teaching English. Okay. I've always had a strong background in languages, too, so I was able to use that to teach in Turkey.
As well.
Yeah.
All right. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Berkeley, California, and Austin, Texas.
So university family?
Yes, academics.
What did your parents teach?
Well, my father is a linguistics professor at the University of Texas at Austin. My mother had been an ESL teacher, English as a second language, but has now moved on to computers, so she's no longer in academia.
And you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother, yeah.
Okay. Has he made the same choice as you have in terms of being a secular Jew?
Yes. He probably wouldn't even view it as a choice as much as a natural kind of result of our upbringing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me reintroduce our guest for people who may have tuned into this program late. This is Keeping the Faith, and this is an unusual program in that it is not live. And so, sadly, I can't encourage you to call with your own questions or comments, but I'll do my best to ask probing questions of our guest today to try to hold up some of our listeners' ends of concerns and interests. But in order to schedule our guest, we did have to tape this program, record it, and we're recording it on the 12th of May. And we realize that by the time this is broadcast in 3 or 4 weeks, some situations may have changed, but our guess is that they won't have changed so dramatically that this won't be an interesting program. So, again, I apologize that you cannot talk to our guest by phone, but our guest today is Anna Baltzer.
And there is a way of contacting me. I do have a website.
Oh, good. What is that?
If people are interested. It is annainthemiddleeast.com. Anna in the Middle East, A-N-N-A, in the Middle East, all one word, .com.
And you mentioned that you have had a book published. Is it widely available at this point?
The situation, my book is called Witness in Palestine, Journal of a Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. And it was published by Paradigm Publishers, but currently I'm the sole distributor of the paperback copies, which you can get on that website, aninthemiddleeast.com. Meanwhile, hardcovers for libraries and universities are available through the publisher.
All right. Well, let's talk about your experience that led to the book. And when was the book published, by the way?
In February of 2006.
Okay. So your first trip to the occupied territories, as you describe it, what are those occupied territories?
When I talk about the occupied territories, I'm referring to those occupied in 1967 by the Israeli army, and those are in Gaza Strip and the West Bank. I was living in the West Bank in a village there.
And why did the Israeli army occupy those territories in 1967?
Well, it depends who you ask. I think the common sort of what I learned growing up was that simply Israel had been time and time again attacked by surrounding countries, a very aggressive sort of anti-Semitic or Jew-hating neighbors, and that Israel has sort of ever since been trying to defend itself. In a sort of preemptive attack in 1967, in which it did occupy many territories, including those Palestinian territories that I spent time in. And I think the growing sort of perspective, understanding of history is a little bit less kind of black and white. I mean, I think that that there have been a lot of decisions made by the Israeli government. A lot of Israeli historians will chime in with me to agree that a lot of decisions, including, I think, that strike in 1967, have perhaps been in part about security, but also very much about control and power. And that, in fact, that occupation of those territories, which was immediately condemned by the international community and United Nations Security Council Resolution 242, for example, called for Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories and talked about sort of the inadmissibility of acquisition of territory through force. And Israel has simply never withdrawn and continues to become an even more overwhelming presence in those territories. And so that's the situation that we have right now.
So when you first visited, and tell our listeners again the year you first went.
Oh, I went in 2003 for the first time, and I've been back every year since.
2003. And how long were you able to stay in 2003?
I was there for 2 months from the end of 2003 into 2004. I was there for 3 months in 2005 and a few times here and there, just short trips doing kind of logistical work for my book.
And who sponsored you, or did you go on your own, pay your own way, just wander around? How did that happen?
I did raise my own money, funds to get there, but I worked with a group called the International Women's Peace Service, which is based in the West Bank. And basically the group is there to, first of all, document human rights abuses in the region, as well as to support nonviolent resistance to the occupation. So I was living with other international volunteers from the same group in a village called Hadis in the West Bank. And we would sort of commute to different parts of the West Bank according to what was needed by Palestinians or Israeli activists doing actions as well along with Palestinians.
I've never personally been privileged to travel in that part of the world, and some of our listeners have not as well, although many I'm sure have. Tell us your first impression.
Well, first of all, I was very shocked, like, aesthetically, the way it looked. I guess I'd imagine Palestine was going to be like this barren desert kind of sand dunes thing, and it was just really green and beautiful land, very fertile. But initially, you know, of course, you go a little bit deeper, and it's just so tragic the way that things have been structured now, such that in this beautiful part of the world, you have things like segregation. You have separate roads. There are Palestinians and Israelis living in those territories, but they use different roads. There's Israeli roads and Palestinian roads, and the Palestinian roads are often dirt roads, and they're not as nice as the more modern Israeli roads, and Palestinians aren't really allowed to use the roads except for special sort of certain cases when they can get a permit for a certain part. But you have segregated license plates, you have checkpoints and roadblocks that have been set up throughout the West Bank. Many people assume that checkpoints like, you know, most border crossings in the world are actually between Israel and the occupied territories, but actually the majority of the checkpoints are between Palestinian towns and villages, which makes it really difficult for a person to travel just a short distance to get to work, to get to school, to get to the hospital, because of being sort of stopped constantly and waiting in lines for hours and at these checkpoints. I guess there was this kind of partial sort of just sort of love for the people in land, and at the same time, just tragic, just sadness and grief at what's happened, and wanting to take an active role in changing that.
Since you before had 10 days in Israel on a Jewish birthright tour, you heard some of the Israeli side on why those checkpoints are necessary. Did any of that make sense to you?
When I initially heard it, sure. I mean, I think I've gotten a very strong understanding of I don't want to call it the Israeli narrative because there's so many different Israelis with different ideas and perspectives, but of, I guess, what my grandmother might use to justify the checkpoints and what the army and government typically does. But I think what was so striking to me is that, for example, you know, the checkpoints is a good example where it's supposedly for the security and safety of Israelis. Meanwhile, most of the checkpoints are actually set up between Palestinian towns and villages. So a woman who was going into labor in her village, and if it's in the middle of the night, I interviewed a woman to whom this happened, and the checkpoint outside her village is open from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, but she went into labor in the middle of the night, and she couldn't get out of her village. The soldiers wouldn't let her pass because she's Palestinian, and it's a road that Palestinians can't go on after certain hours, and she wasn't able to reach the hospital in time. Her two twin babies died as a result. And you know, I feel like the word security has come to be used so broadly and such that people, as soon as you say security, it's kind of like, oh, okay. And there's no really further justification needed. But, you know, if it's about security, why would you place the checkpoints between Palestinians and their work and their their source of education, schools, universities, and their hospitals and each other? I mean, what is the logic in that? I think a lot of it is about sort of strengthening control and power, and particularly control over the land and as well as the water sources in the region. Something that, you know, the U.S. does the exact same thing, makes similar decisions, not so much what's going to be the best in terms of safety for all Americans, but what's going to be the best economically in terms of control for the United States. And I think Israel's doing the exact same thing.
Now, on that first trip, when you were able to spend a couple months there as part of the International Women's Peace Service group, how large was the group?
It varies from, I've been there when there was two of us to when there were 12 of us in the house itself, but there's, there are probably about 100 volunteers, members, I would say, I would estimate.
And where do most of them come from?
From particularly Western countries, a lot of them from the U.S. and Canada, also Europe, some from South Africa, a few from Australia, and maybe a few others from different countries.
Now, how many Americans?
I don't know exactly how many.
But 10%?
More than 10%. Disproportionately large percent of Americans.
And how many were Jewish Americans?
Again, disproportionately large number. I've heard a stat that 30 to 40% of the sort of activists like me going to work with these kinds of organizations are actually Jewish. Mm. So there's a large percent, as well as, of course, the Jewish-Israeli presence that is becoming larger, actively opposing the policies that their government has adopted.
Let's talk about the government policies for a moment. And again, let me reintroduce our guest. Anna Baltzer is on Keeping the Faith today. This is a program we've needed to record before it's broadcast, and it was recorded on the 12th of May. Anna, when you visited the Palestinian territories at that point, the territories occupied by Israel. What was the political situation then in that year?
To the territories.
Yeah.
In 2003, so let's see, this was, you know, still during the Second Intifada, of course, I would say the occupation was very well established already at that point. First of all, you had the checkpoints and roadblocks I spoke of. You had the settlements and outposts, sort of Jewish-only, really, colonies that have been built up on Palestinian land that are only for Jewish people. And they are dotted all over the landscape, and there are hundreds of those, and they were already there. And in particular, that was the year after the beginning of the construction of the wall that is now being built. Another thing which I think is often justified for security, certainly that's been what I've learned a lot from a lot of Israelis and internationals I speak to. However, what a lot of people don't know is that the wall itself is not actually being built on the border between Israel and the Palestinian territories, but on Palestinian land, 80% of it not even touching the border, but snaking in, kind of annexing a lot, again, of that land and water into Israeli control.
And what was the government of the Palestinian territories at that time?
Arafat was still alive at that point.
And so Hamas?
Hamas had a presence, but they were not the leading party.
Okay.
It was Fatah.
And in your last visit, Hamas had just...
In my last visit, I was there the day when Hamas was elected to the majority of the seats.
And what was the feeling like among Palestinians at that point?
There was a lot of sort of enthusiasm about the elections. I wasn't there. I left kind of the day the sort of results were coming out. And so I didn't get to see the reactions of everybody. But I know on election day, people were very enthusiastic about going to the polls. You had a really high election voter rate. And and people were, you know, holding flags of their party and very enthusiastic about democracy.
Mm-hmm. And Fatah?
Fatah came out the kind of the loser this time.
But they were in power the first time you were there.
That's correct.
Uh-huh. And what was that like?
Well, I mean, my sort of experience has been that the actual, I mean, they call it a Palestinian government, but I sort of call it a mock government. I mean, a normal government is supposed to be able to sort of make decisions to sort of protect its civilians, its citizens, look out for their interests. And at this point, the Palestinian government really doesn't have the kind of power to even make even small decisions about what happens to its people. And so the situation you have because of the occupation is there's this constant undermining by the Israeli army. I mean, I interviewed police forces that had been their places had been raided, et cetera. And so, basically, the point I want to make is that it's hard to feel too many effects of the actual Palestinian authority because of their lack of power actually over the way the system is structured and sort of the way people's daily lives are. And so, I didn't really feel it that much. I mean, Arafat. Not long after Arafat was his compound was surrounded and he had virtually less power than ever before. So
now I know you personally you've told us you personally are not religious, but what was the religious setting in Palestine as you discovered it?
A lot of Palestinians I met are people of faith. I mean, many of them identify as Muslims. Many Palestinians are also Christian. And I think that particularly in a place with such growing desperation, a lot of people do really turn to faith as to have some sort of hope, I would say. It's hard for me to understand that. I mean, it's hard for me to describe it on a deep level because I can only talk about sort of my personal perspective. But I know that, a lot of demonstrations where people would go down to where the wall was being built, they would go down with the intention of praying on their land. Huge communities would come together alongside colleagues in the resistance from Israel and from the U.S. and other places. But to go in and to pray on that land, knowing that for this could be the last time they'd ever, touch, feel their land. And it was quite moving the way people would turn to worship as a way of saying goodbye to their land or a way of kind of being on their land for the last time, and also of course worshiping. And I know that a lot of Palestinians do, are people of faith, and a lot of their lives surround a lot of that.
Were you able to visit any mosques or churches in Palestine when you were there?
Sure. A lot of life surrounds the life at mosques and churches. Let's see, the churches I visited were in East Jerusalem, I guess, not mm-hmm. many in Bethlehem as well. Yeah, sure. It's beautiful there.
And did you talk to leaders of those religious communities? Were those some of the folks you were able to talk to and interview?
Yeah, I mean, one of the demonstrations I took part in was at was a march on Palm Sunday in 2005 in Bethlehem, in which basically the Christian community, led in part by Holy Land Trust, which is a group of Palestinian Christians that have become very become strong in the resistance alongside people in the community in Bethlehem, as well as Muslim Palestinians and internationals. Coming together to sort of march to a checkpoint with the intention of crossing it, because one of the main effects of the occupation, in particular of the wall, is that it's separating the Palestinians from Jerusalem, which to them is a very a holy city. It's not only holy for Jewish people, and so people feel. I mean, you have people who can practically see Jerusalem from their homes, but can never visit it, and so you have there was this demonstration in which people wanted to. They said, why can't we go to Jerusalem? We're Christians, we're Muslims, why can't we go to our holy sites? People mobilizing around that in a way to stand up for their rights as religious people, and also for their rights as human beings in the movement.
By the time this program airs, you will have left Champaign-Urbana, where you've been here speaking to several different groups. As you look back on your visit to Champaign-Urbana, what were some of the good questions that were asked? And tell us where you spoke and what, what some of the questions were that were challenging to you.
Let's see. I've spoken. I spoke at Pages for All Ages. I gave a little author's book signing and reading there. I spoke as well at a church last night.
Community United Church of Christ.
That's exactly right. A church that the pastor there, his name is Michael, he was very enthusiastic about the work that the church has been doing. So it was actually great.
Mike Mulberry.
Mike Mulberry, thank you. Sounds like there's been excellent sort of work being done among these communities here, which was very exciting for me to hear about. So let's see. I had some great questions. People are always curious about Hamas. People are always curious about one versus two state. People are always curious, sort of about me, what my experience had been. Was I in danger? Did I feel welcomed by Palestinians? Did I experience anti-Semitism? These are typical sort of questions.
Tell us how you would reveal to people there that you were Jewish.
This is a lot in my book. I talk about the trepidation I had at the beginning of telling people, you know, I'm a Jewish person. How are they going to react? People had told me they're gonna kill you if they find out you're Jewish, and that never happened. Not once in 5 months did I have people who responded to my confession, so to speak, with anything but sort of openness and tolerance. People were sometimes surprised until they, of course, realized that there is a difference between being Jewish and Israeli and being Israeli and supporting the Israeli government and army. So generally, people were extremely open. I mean, embarrassingly hospitable and generous, such that they wouldn't want me to leave. They wanted to keep sort of showering me with their generosity. And so I felt I would end up feeling very comfortable talking about myself as a Jewish person.
When you talk about the Palestinians showering you with their generosity, are not these on the whole poor people?
Yeah, that's particularly why it's so. It's so moving and touching that when people whose lives are kind of crumbling around them sometimes, I mean, even literally their homes being destroyed, a wall being built up around their communities, that they share the little that they have and the kind of just the incredible dignity that Palestinians have maintained in spite of a lot of a very humiliating sort of system that they're living in. It's humbling.
Muslims, Jews, and Christians are all alike told to be very hospitable to strangers. Could you tell us what that felt like in a Palestinian Muslim home?
Yeah,
for example?
And throughout the Muslim world, and throughout the Middle East, among Christian families as well. In Turkey, where I lived for several years, it was the same thing, where people would sort of. Ask me where I'm from. They're very curious about me. The more of a novelty it was to see someone like me walking around in Iran, for example. It's so rare to see an American girl just kind of wandering around that people were very protective. They wanted to invite me home and sort of make sure that I was okay and well fed. In Iran, I spent 2 weeks there. I was not once did I end up having to pay for a hotel or eat or what I was eating. Everywhere I went, people would invite me home with them and to stay with them. And similar things happened in Palestine as well. It's incredible to feel that love and sense of family among people that are basically strangers to you. But there's this common kind of identity as humans and kind of as that community-oriented society.
We're about halfway through our program today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. And our guest today is Anna Baltzer. For those who'd like an opportunity to correspond with her, since we're unable to have this be a live program this week on Keeping the Faith, you may contact her at her website, which is
annainthemiddleeast.com. That's A-N-N-A in the Middle East.com.
This program is partially supported by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution here at the University of Illinois. It was founded by students back in 1873, and for the last 133 years or so, the Y has been open for many of these last decades, over 50 years, to people of any religious faith or tradition or of none. We also have secular students who are very active in our Y programs, who are doing volunteering in the schools, who are working for justice and fighting poverty and working with Amnesty International and working to improve the environment. So the Y is a very active place, and I've been privileged to be the director there for the last almost 7 years now. And the Y survives because of its friends, just like this public radio program is partially supported by listeners. The Y has supporters from many different religious traditions who appreciate the kind of work that we do. This summer, for example, we're collecting things for a grand sale that we have in the fall when new students arrive, and particularly international students who come here with maybe just a couple suitcases and need to furnish an apartment. We have a sale in the Stock Pavilion, which is coming up in August, late August, the first week of school. It's also open to people in the community, and folks who would like to donate to that sale may bring items to the Stock Pavilion starting on the 15th of August. Household items, furniture, anything that students would like for apartments, or things that you're just tired of, want to get rid of, but still have some value or usefulness. This keeps things out of the waste stream, and the Y is able to sell them very inexpensively to people and yet still make some money to help support our programs. The Y also accepts vehicle donations. So if you have a car or a boat or a pickup truck or even a motorcycle, anything with a title, if you'd like to donate it to the Y, do call me, Steve Shoemaker, 337-1500. That's in area code 217. And you will get the ability to deduct that gift on your taxes the next year for whatever we can sell that item for. And, of course, we're motivated to sell it for a decent price to help the Y. So that number again, 217-337-1500, and my name is Steve Shoemaker. Well, let's get back to our guest for today. We're talking with Anna Baltzer. Her last name is spelled Baltzer, a Columbia University graduate who received a Fulbright scholarship to teach English in Turkey and became very interested in the Middle East, and particularly in the cause of the Palestinians. She visited there several times and has written a book about her experiences called Witness in Palestine. Tell us the subtitle again, Anna.
Journal of a Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories.
And again, I apologize to listeners who'd like to ask questions or make comments. We've had to record this program earlier on the 12th of May for broadcast at this time. Anna, you were telling us about how hospitable the Palestinians were to you, even after they discovered that you were Jewish, that you come from a family of your grandmother, you said, was a Holocaust survivor. Tell us what that was like in terms of. Did you wear a head covering when you were in the parts of Palestine where it was mainly Muslim?
In Palestine, no, I never wore a head covering. In Iran, I was it's mandatory, but everywhere else, I certainly didn't need to cover my head. I mean, there are so many Palestinian Christians and others in Palestine who don't cover their heads that it's not unheard of in Palestine. But I would sort of cover my shoulders and wear sort of modest dress,
sure.
And I would even consider I've thought about even covering my head. I mean, it's not. It has such a stigma attached to it in this culture, but actually for a lot of women, it's a way of simply being modest, you know,
sure.
Not flaunting yourself. And I, you know, if I'm already going to cover my shoulders, why wouldn't I go mm-hmm. the extra step to sort of conform and not stand out more than I need to and already
right.
do as a Westerner.
Right. And what did you do in terms of your what you would eat? Because each of the religious groups in that part of the world has certain dietary restrictions and rules and laws. What would you do?
Well, it depended if we were at the apartment with the other internationals, and there we would just kind of eat whatever there was. Sometimes make meals together, but a lot of times we would be staying with farmers and their families during the olive harvest. For example, we'd go out with farmers for several days in a row to their land that they might not actually be able to go to because of settlers or soldiers preventing them from doing that. And we would sit with them and eat out, you know, under the olive trees, you know, bread with olive oil and olives, along with wonderful. I mean, sometimes there will be a virtual feast there with you know, rice, chicken, vegetables, etc., yogurt, spinach, and sometimes it would be something modest, particularly with families that had had less to offer. We would just simply enjoy some fresh sage tea that you could pick up, you know, pick out of the weeds there, and there's a nice. I mean, along with the, of course, eating is very important in many cultures. The sort of community feeling generated by people coming, you know, breaking bread together, and that was certainly true. We would share a lot of wonderful meals with people that would turn into friendships and alliances that were very useful in the movement and just, you know, on a personal level.
Let me raise some of the hard questions about the situation in Palestine. Since our listeners aren't able to do that, let me try to at least reflect some of the questions I suspect some of them have for you. Do you agree with Hamas that the state of Israel should not exist at all?
Gosh, I wouldn't. I don't know how to answer that. Put as it is. I mean, I think Hamas. Let's see. Hamas's manifesto is quite aggressive. I'm not sure whether I would subscribe to that or not. But I think if the question is whether I would support a one or two state solution, is that kind of what you're getting at? Or
well, that would be another question. Sure.
Oh, okay. I mean, because in terms of Hamas, I mean, I think that if what one is looking for is a two state solution, then certainly I think Hamas's some of Hamas's claims in the manifesto are an obstacle to peace, but I don't really think that they're more of an obstacle to peace than a lot of the decisions the Israeli government has made. So, in other words, if we're going to ask Hamas to recognize the right of Israel to exist, we need to ask Israel to recognize the right of Palestinians to be on that land. And there's been this kind of throughout the past few decades, Israel has on a few occasions sort of offered, okay, if you do X, Y, and Z, and we can maintain control over X percent of your land for the next X many years, or Y, you know, that then perhaps then we'll entertain the idea of giving you a state. It's not Israel's to give. Palestinians have as much a right as anyone to be on that land. They've been there very recently, and a lot of them are desperate for some kind of sovereignty and control over their lives. And so there has not been any kind of acknowledgement on the part of Israel of Palestinians' right to be there and right to that land, much of which Israel has been occupying now for almost 40 years. And similarly, while we're on the topic of Hamas, I mean, Hamas has claimed responsibility for a number of murderous attacks against Israelis, which are tragic. My heart goes out to the victims of those families, or the families of those victims. But I think what's interesting is that we kind of are banding together, coming together with Israel to demand that Hamas condemn all violent attacks against Israelis. Meanwhile, we've never actually come together and asked Israel to condemn all violent attacks by Israelis upon Palestinians. I mean, settlers who the Israeli government and we, as the U.S. government, support financially, attack Palestinians, even kill Palestinians. The soldiers have also killed four times more Palestinian civilians than Israeli civilians who have been killed. I'm talking only about civilians here. Actually, in the Israeli number, soldiers are even counted. So, in other words, I feel like we have this kind of double standard when it comes to Hamas. I'm not here to sort of defend Hamas for everything that it is. I think that's not even my place as an outsider here. But I think that we need to have a more sort of even-handed perspective with all of this.
Let's talk a little bit about the land. Since you visited with the West Bank, how do you respond to Israeli concerns that it's so easy to lob explosives from that particular territory into Israel? If Israel does have a right to exist with some degree of safety, can you understand why they would be very nervous to give total control of that to people who, some of whom at least, want to drive them off the whole continent?
I think that any country has a right to defend itself. I think, first of all, I mean, realistically, if you look at polls, the majority of Palestinians don't support violent attacks against Israel. And so it's inaccurate when some people, you weren't saying this, but that a lot of people, I think, have an assumption that most Palestinians are there sort of plotting to push the Jews into the sea. And that's just not the case. I mean, I've met so many Palestinians and not one who had that mentality. Even those who support Hamas are often supporting Hamas for the social welfare programs that it provides, and not so much about violent resistance. But I think I think it's also important just to look what has Israel actually been doing. I mean, I know what Israel's been saying: we want security, we want safety, we want peace. What has Israel been doing? Israel, the settlements that I mentioned before, which are basically towns, villages, communities that are built up on Palestinian land that are exclusively for Jewish people. And what it's been doing is building more and more of these communities, which I would call colonies. It's something similar to the colonization that's happened in other countries around the world. It's not something unique to Israel. Israel actually offers financial incentives, subsidizes people to go live in these territories, to leave Israel and go live on Palestinian land. If you are trying to secure your population, you do not pay them to go and live on the land of the, you know, quote unquote enemy. You know, if you're trying to secure your population, you do not build a wall that's annexing as much of the land and water as possible from the so-called enemy. If you have, you know, if your next door neighbor is bothering you, you don't, and you want to build a fence, well, you build a fence between your house and theirs. You don't build a fence around their house so that they can't move anymore. I mean, that's just, it's absurd logic to justify this stuff. I mean, the attacks, I mean, it's just, you could have more security right now if you lined the international border with soldiers than you do right now, placing checkpoints strategically, preventing Palestinians from being able to get an education. I mean, if you want extremism to go down, you want people to be educated, you want a democracy, you want people who are not desperate. And right now what's happening is the Palestinians are being literally starved now that the aid has been cut off. The Palestinians can no longer work, can no longer get to school. This is not the path to peace for anybody. This is not strategic for Palestinians, obviously, and not even for Israel. So I don't buy those claims that this is all about security.
Let me just remind listeners, Anna just said the aid has been cut off. That's as of still May 12 when this program is being recorded. By the time it's broadcast, things may have changed, but we, of course, neither one of us probably can accurately predict the future. Anna, we've talked a little bit about the land. Let's talk about the people themselves. How do you respond to the Israeli claim that before the creation of the State of Israel by the United Nations in 1948, there were really very few residents of that territory?
That is inaccurate. I mean, that has been disproven so many times by Israeli, if you look in the Israeli archives, Israeli historians and academics will tell you time and time again that the slogan, a land without a people for a people without a land, is just inaccurate. There were many people living there. In fact, when Jewish immigration began in the late 19th century, the Jews represented less than, I think it was around 7% of the population. And then as it grew by 1947, right before the State of Israel was created, they represented still 30%, but it was never, there was always a sizable Palestinian majority.
But you wouldn't deny that the success of, the economic success of the State of Israel, you wouldn't deny that that's attracted a lot of people from the area who now call themselves Palestinians, who perhaps didn't live there before.
I'm not sure what you mean. The definition for me of a Palestinian is someone who did live there before. So perhaps you mean Arab people who've moved to Israel?
Sure.
Who? Because I don't know of too many Arab people who've moved to Israel who aren't Palestinian.
Okay. So you would say that most of the people there who currently today would call themselves Palestinian have family roots there immediately.
Yeah, and that's, I think, a key distinction to make. A lot of times among my Jewish Israeli friends and family, there's Jewish Israelis and there's Arab Israelis, but there's not really a distinction made between Arabs in the entire Arab world and Arabs who were there during the time when Zionist immigration began and when the State of Israel was created, that there are people who have this historic claim to the land. And that's the importance, I think, of having a separate word, a distinguishing word. It doesn't matter if it's the word Palestinian or Palestine. It probably matters to Palestinians, and that's why I use it. But I think the important thing is to make that distinction. And, 20% of the Israeli population with Israeli citizenship is Palestinian. And of course, the vast majority of the people living in the occupied territories, with the exception of the settlers, are Palestinian as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, the millions of Palestinians now in the diaspora who have that historic claim to the land.
Land, people, and of course politics.
Right.
We touched a little bit on religion, but in terms of politics, are you personally in favor of the two-state solution, of a two-state solution?
My basic answer to that question is that it's not really my – it's not really our decision to make. I mean, for me to say, as a Jewish American, I'm not Israeli, I'm not Palestinian, to say you guys should work things out and you should do X. You know, it's – I think that it's totally appropriate for me as an American person to be in outrage at what is being done with my U.S. dollars as an American taxpayer. I think it's appropriate as a Jewish person to stand up against what's being done in my name, the human rights violations, the violations of international law being done in my name as a Jewish person. However, if we could get to the point where Jews, Jewish Israelis, and Palestinians could come together and actually sort of make a decision about this, where both had enough sort of bargaining power that they could make a decision that was good for both sides, that I would not see it as my role to butt in and say, no, you guys should do something different. That said, I do think that, you know, if the occupation, which is what I focus most of my work on, if that were to end tomorrow, you would not have a resolution of all the problems. You would still have the Palestinian population living in Israel who are second-class citizens. You would still have the millions of Palestinians living in the diaspora who have no citizenship or rights as citizens anywhere, and who many of them would like to return to their homes and land. They carry kind of keys around their necks sometimes to houses that still exist in Israel where Jewish families are living, but where they can never return. And so the way I see it is that you have about 10 million Palestinians, many of them Christian, the majority of them Muslim, and you have about 5 million Jewish Israelis, all of whom have some recent historic claim to this land. And you know, how are you going to resolve that? And I mean, if you want to preserve a Jewish state, and that's where I was for most of my life, feeling that there must be a state for Jewish people, and everything else has to kind of come from that. But what that looks like, because of the demographics, is that you have either a sort of ruling of the majority of the Christians and Muslims by the minority Jewish population, what you have right now, where you don't have a democracy, where you don't have equal rights, where Jewish people have more rights than other people, or you can have, well, you could also have, you know, mass imprisonment and expulsion and genocide even. These are also options, but none of them are very appealing. Or you can have democracy. And until I see a situation in which people who are Christian and people who are Muslim have as many rights as people who are Jewish in this part of the world, I will not support. I would not support a Jewish state that didn't offer equal rights to people who are Christian and Muslim. And so far, I don't see a way of that being worked out.
Since the election of Hamas, there's been a surprising reduction in violence on both sides. That's been celebrated at least up until May 12, when we're talking. Why do you think that is?
I would argue with that. There has been a reduction from the Palestinian side. A few weeks ago when I checked, I think it was about 15 Israelis had been killed so far this year since January 1st. 15, and that's horrible. That's 15 people who were killed. At the same time, though, in that same period of time, over 90 Palestinians, Palestinian civilians had been killed. And when we hear about ceasefires, it's usually talking about no Israelis have been killed for a while. Palestinians continue to be killed every day. Civilians, I'm talking about, not suicide bombers, not people targeted by or assassination by the Israeli army. We simply don't hear about those deaths. They're no longer news because it's so common.
What do you see would take to bring a complete reduction in violence?
I think it would involve a real sort of change in policy on Israel's part, and I think that our government could really play a strong role in that. The U.S. government, because of the financial support that we provide to Israel, we have a lot of bargaining power, and if we were to demand the same demands that we put on Palestinians and on Hamas on Israel, I think it would be a huge change. If we were to say to Israel that you need to allow Palestinians to live in peace in the same way that we're asking that of Palestinians, it could mean huge changes. Israel could not continue building this wall that is separating Palestinians from their land and each other. It could not continue to have the same kind of institutions in the occupation.
What drives someone to be a suicide bomber?
I think a lot of things. It's hard to say exactly. I've never known someone who who carried out a violent attack against Israel. But I think it partially comes from desperation. People who feel like they kind of have nothing else to lose. They can know, you know, if you're a Palestinian growing up in the territories, what are your prospects? You can hardly get an education. There's no, you know, you can't get a job. You can't move around. You can't go visit your family outside of whoever lives in your tiny little area. You can't leave. You can't, I mean, it's like there's nothing. So I think part of it might be something like people have nothing else to lose. But I think a lot of it, for some people, it's a strategic thing. I mean, I think that some people would argue even that because there was so much violence coming out of Gaza that was one of the things that led to Israel actually withdrawing the settlers and soldiers. So there are probably Palestinians who feel that it has actually gained some sort of strategic bargaining power for Palestinians, and that might be part of it as well. Statistics show that the suicide bombers are not all sort of incredibly desperate, sort of poor people, but actually a lot of them are even educated Palestinians who are doing it for other reasons besides desperation. I don't know too much else. I've heard the movie Paradise Lost is very good, but haven't seen it yet.
You said earlier you felt that one thing that drives the Israeli government to set up checkpoints and to build walls is a concern for control and power. But do you see also that there is some concern for safety?
Sure. I think that's the reason why the majority of Israelis, I take that back, not the majority, but why Israelis, I think, are okay with the situation right now. But, you know, that's not even true either. The majority of Israelis actually don't support the settlements, don't support the occupation as it is. A lot of, it's interesting, the American population is much more supportive of these institutions than the Israeli population is. So whenever people criticize me trying to stand up for the Israelis, I remind them that many Israelis actually agree with the work that I'm doing. But I think that people, Israelis, the average Israeli, just like the average Palestinian, they just want peace. They want peace for their families. They want to live their lives. And that the fear that has been propagated by first of all, by, I think, a lot of the media, but also by these suicide attacks, these violent attacks against Israelis, has led a lot of Israelis to perhaps allow things to happen that they otherwise wouldn't. I think the same thing is happening in the United States, that the fear that has been generated by attacks like September 11th led a lot of Americans to perhaps allow a lot more, allow our government to do a lot, many things that we otherwise wouldn't have. And so I think that fear plays a large role in it.
Let me apologize again to listeners for not letting you be a part of this conversation with our guest, Anna Baltzer, on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. We've needed to record this on May 12th. For broadcast at this time because of Anna's schedule and my prior commitments on our usual live program of Keeping the Faith. Anna, tell us a little bit about your future coming up. What are you going to be doing this summer? Where are you going to be speaking? This program is heard from Indianapolis to Chicago, and people travel all over these days. Where are you going to be, and where are you going to be? Where might people be able to actually hear you speak and ask questions personally?
Well, I've been on tour now for over 3 months, and I've spoken in all the places you just mentioned, going really literally around the country, giving hundreds of talks at universities and communities.
Is someone sponsoring you with that?
I'm basically at this point, I have different hosts and sponsors, mm-hmm. different peace and justice groups and universities who organize things, but the sort of financial sponsorship comes, first of all, from honorariums, from book purchases, from donations. I'm not being sponsored by any individual or organization in particular. But I intend to continue doing this work. I've generated a lot of enthusiasm so far, so I want to keep that rolling and hopefully people can start taking action. So I will be touring around. I'm giving several conferences in the next year, and all the information on that, on my talks, I have a DVD of the talk, etc., is on my website, which is annainthemiddleeast.com.
And you have a schedule there that people could go to you will be.
Yeah, this is the tail end of this large trip, so I'm going to have a few months to put out a second edition of the book and go back to Palestine. But eventually I will be on tour again in all of the places where this show is aired and more. So definitely check out my website. The book is also available there, Witness in Palestine, Journal of a Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. And that's full of lots of photographs and stories.
And where do you live now?
These days, I live in my car, just kind of touring around the U.S., but I've lived off and on in Turkey for several years now, and I have also a base in Colorado where my mom lives.
And will you be going back to Turkey anytime soon?
Sure, in a few months.
And what about Palestine?
Absolutely, hopefully later this year.
When people go to your website, how easy is it to navigate?
It's very simple, actually. I've tried to keep it as simple as possible.
Tell us what they will find. What's your homepage like?
Let's see. The homepage, the first page is as simple as can be. It's a little list of different links. I talk about there's the photos, my writings, my DVD, well, my presentations, which includes the tour and my upcoming schedule, as well as a DVD that's available for order of the talk itself. I also have a link to my new book, which you can order online, and you can read a few sample chapters, the introduction. I have a place where you can join my email list to get eyewitness accounts from Palestine once a week when I'm there, and also just to email me if you have comments and questions. I'm sorry if folks didn't get a chance to call me this time, but I'm certainly available if people have questions, concerns.
Let me ask about your family. Does your mother worry when you're in Palestine?
My parents, I think, got used to this a while ago since I started traveling around the world and in the Middle East and stuff. Nowadays, when I'm just touring the U.S., it's just nothing compared to what I've done before. But yeah, I think there is some fear. But because I'm such a person of privilege there as an American, as a Jewish person, as a white person, I experience a lot of people, the soldiers oftentimes will pick me out and say, you don't have to stand in checkpoint, you know, you're American. So I don't feel, I feel that I'm so much safer than most of the people around me, and that sort of humbles me a bit.
You've said you're not a religious person yourself, but if you were and had a prayer, what would your prayer be for Palestine?
I would pray,
may be the hardest question of all.
This is the hardest question. I don't have an answer for that. I would just pray that there be some kind of justice. And I know that if there is justice in which, you know, people get on some level something that they deserve, and that there is some amends that are made in terms of the past and what's happening now. And I just know that peace will come from that. When people have justice, all people want peace, you know, everyone has that peace inside them, and I think that there could be peace if there were justice. So that's my prayer.
Let me thank our guest on Keeping the Faith today, Anna Baltzer, for spending this hour with us. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these programs. I'm the executive director of the University YMCA. The Y is eager to encourage people to donate items that still have some value that perhaps they're tired of from their house or attic or basement, furniture, household items, things like that, to our grand dump and run sale. Back in the spring, early in May, students donated many things as they were leaving campus, but community people are also encouraged to bring things following August 15 to the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue in Urbana. We're having a grand sale the first week of school, and many entering students and international students who come to the university will find some great bargains and be able to settle their apartments and dorms. So, do call the Y if you have questions. 217-337-1500. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
When Meg Gaines was diagnosed with terminal cancer, her doctor told her to go home and think about the quality of her life. Instead, she grabbed him by the bow tie and said, "I don't think you understand. I intend to live." Today, Meg Gaines is helping other cancer patients stand up for their lives. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, How to Live Well with Cancer. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 on WILL Urbana.
WILL programming is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake, suspension, preventative maintenance, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available, 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, mostly clear with a low in the lower 70s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour this evening, then becoming light. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 80s and south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour in the evening, becoming light. This is WILL Urbana, listener-supported public radio. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.